It's January 29th, 2014, and welcome to another edition of Bite Marks Cafe, where we serve you the first bite of today's technology. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ran Ozawa, and we'll cover the Geek Beat here on Hawaii Public Radio.
First, we'll look at the latest tech news and happenings in Hawaii and beyond. And joining us today is Zuma Aguiar to tell us about the upcoming Rails Bridge event called Hear Me Roar.
Finally, we'll explore how unmanned aerial vehicles or drones might play a role in Hawaii's future. We'd love your questions and thoughts as part of the conversation, so be ready to call in or tweet. But first, the headlines.
Air pollution in Asia has been rising for decades, with smog-filled skies in China making headlines in recent weeks. Global wind patterns carry such pollution eastward over the Pacific, and Hawaii is often in its path. A new study backed by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration seeks to explain how ozone pollution levels from Asia fluctuate over the Hawaiian Islands. Studying historical measurements from atop Mauna Kea and climate models going back to 1975.
While ozone serves as a protective layer at high altitudes, its presence near Earth's surface is a greenhouse gas, and Asian emissions have tripled over the past few decades. But 40 years of atmospheric records show surprisingly little change in ozone levels here in the islands. Hawaii largely escapes a direct hit from Asian ozone pollution that drifts east with seasonal spring winds, but it does see rising levels in the fall. Researchers now believe that pattern is caused by significant shifts in atmospheric circulation that have occurred since the mid-1990s. For example, long-term La Nina cooling in the first decade of this century.
And lead researcher Mei-Yun Lin said that changing wind patterns effectively hide the increase in Asian pollution reaching Hawaii early in the year. And the study also highlights the importance of having a decades-long view of climate conditions when measuring ozone trends. Lin said in a statement, the study not only solves the mystery of Hawaiian ozone changes since 1974, but also has a broad implication for interpreting trends in surface ozone levels globally. Now, you know, the interesting thing is that they were expecting higher levels in the spring, but it actually turns out there's much higher levels at ground ozone in the fall.
Mm-hmm. And also that it hasn't risen the same way it has globally or obviously over Asia. So they're basically saying what's happening. And I always find these studies really interesting because it sounds like, once again, Hawaii just manages to dodge a bullet given circulation trends and where we're located. It could be the opposite. It could be that the changing weather patterns drives that stuff directly at us. Mm-hmm. But in this case, it happens to be that the way that the climate has changed just over the last 20 years, at the same time this ozone has increased, is going away from us.
Well, and the thing that also was kind of interesting is that in the fall, when the ozone levels are higher, this ground ozone actually has some health risks, because if you have any respiratory, let's say, weaknesses, it'll sort of exacerbate that by sort of affecting your mucous membrane. So it makes it harder to breathe. So if in combination with maybe VOG, I can see where it might be really pretty bad.
What was interesting is that it's a NOAA study. It was actually run primarily out of Princeton. The reason why Hawaii was the focus of the study, and it's not just because Hawaii is really awesome, but because the longest record of ozone measurement atmospherically anywhere in the U.S. is recorded at Mauna Loa here. So because we had the longest record, that's where they focused their study. New research out of UH could go a long way in explaining not only how water and organic material arrived here on planet Earth, but also how likely it is that such building blocks of life reached other planets in our solar system or even exoplanets elsewhere in the galaxy. Working with colleagues at the University of California at Berkeley and the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, scientists at our School of Ocean and Earth Science and Technology discovered that interplanetary dust particles could be the way water and organic compounds are delivered through space.
Well, interplanetary dust comes from comets, asteroids, and other leftover debris from the birth of solar systems, and it continually rains down on Earth and other space bodies. But because these particles are bombarded by solar wind during their travels, their composition can change as they move through space. Hydrogen ions could interact with the silicate mineral crystals in the dust, knocking the atoms out of order and leaving behind oxygen that could interact with hydrogen, thereby creating water molecules.
Hope Ishii, co-author of the study, said in a statement, "It is a thrilling possibility that this influx of dust has acted as a continuous rainfall of little reaction vessels containing both the water and organics needed for the eventual origin of life on Earth and possibly Mars." More importantly, since dust from primitive asteroids and comets are already known to carry organic carbon that can even survive entering the Earth's atmosphere, the study demonstrates that it is possible that water and organics can be delivered together.
So it's just another mechanism by which water could actually accumulate on a planet like Earth. I mean, we always, of course, we take water for granted, right? It's in our ocean. But if you wonder if most of the exoplanets that we talk about are maybe just, you know, rocks, or if you look at Mars, there's hardly any water there. How does all the water happen to be here on Earth? And I think a combination of comets and perhaps this dust is the way it happens.
Well, they specifically say that this first detection of this, they basically used a new transmission electron microscope to look really, really closely at these particles, and they found a thin film of water particles. Mm. But they also went out of their way to say that this is not, we're not saying that this is how the, this is not the volume enough to have brought us an ocean, mm-hmm. but it's just one of many delivery methods. And in fact, the next level of study for this particular group is to try to determine how much water we're talking about. But it's always interesting to see, you know, I mean, we've known since the Apollo era that solar wind can change the chemical makeup of dust. Ever since we've been to the moon, we can see that there's changes at the surface versus what's below mm-hmm. in that dust. So why not demonstrate that this chemical change could give us water?
Now, you know, this lead researcher, Hope Ishii, she has been sort of inducted into the Alameda County Women's Hall of Fame, and she's been working on this since the mid-2000s. So it's something that this, you know, didn't happen overnight.
I mean, this is
a long-time study, so it's good.
Always good to continue to explore where we might have come from.
Well, next up, last week, Governor Neil Abercrombie delivered his annual State of the State address before the Hawaii legislature, outlining the latest priorities of his administration. Science and technology were mentioned. The governor noted that Hawaii is celebrating its 50th year of excellence in astronomy. Abercrombie expressed support for the 30-meter telescope project, the importance of preparing for climate change through governmental policy, and improving sustainability and environmental protection.
The governor announced a plan, for example, to work with a renewable energy company to preserve 20,000 acres of open space on the north shore of Oahu. In related news, Governor Abercrombie on Friday also released $28 million in capital improvement project funds for the Department of Business, Economic Development, and Tourism. More than $13 million of this DBED funding will go toward improving the Natural Energy Laboratory of Hawaii on the Big Island. And most of that, more than $9 million, will go toward a new frontage road that will improve access to the park and to new lots for commercial and research tenants.
Well, the upgrades will open up the upper 80 acres of the Nelha Research Park based on shovel-ready plans submitted to the state legislature and expected to be completed within a year of starting construction. $2 million will go to upgrade the Nelha Seawater Power Generation System, and $1 million will be combined with $3 million in federal funds to convert an administrative building into a 10,000-square-foot alternative energy and biotechnology incubator. Well, there's a, you know, there's a bunch of other projects too that seem to be getting funding. There's a $3 million foreign trade zone import-export incubator, and $1.8 million for 19 permanent project-funded staff position over at HCDA.
So a lot of things basically coming through. I mean, the governor does talk about, you know, a lot of hard decisions, a lot of tough times to get us to having a general fund balance of $844 million. And the challenge always is not to immediately go and spend mm-hmm, that, you know, mm-hmm. how to act fiscally responsible. So it was good to see some specific examples of science and technology expenditures or projects that he said were priorities. You know, they're talking about an ocean resources management plan that they're developing, a Hawaii climate adaptation initiative, invasive species management, e-waste recycling, a lot of these things that we talk about on the show. Mm-hmm. Hopefully some of that funding can move these.
And of course, we're keeping track of things that might affect the Mano Innovation Center and HTDC, and of course, Carl Fuchs and his efforts to get more money for the investment capital.
We'll keep you posted. The Hawaii Regional Science Bowl was held on Saturday at Honolulu Community College, and taking top honors was the team from Maui High School. They'll now be advancing to the 2014 National Science Bowl, which will be held in Washington, D.C. this April. This win actually marks the sixth state title for the Maui team since 2002. The Hawaii Science Bowl has been held since 1994 and has involved nearly 2,000 students from more than 50 high schools.
Well, the Hawaii event was among a handful of regional competitions conducted over the weekend, which together determined 11 teams of middle and high school students that will be going to the national competition. Regional competitions will be conducted across the country through March. In the competition, students are asked questions in subjects ranging from math to physics to chemistry, as well as biology and space science. The Maui News reports that Maui High made it through the Hawaii Science Bowl undefeated, besting Waiakea, Punahou, and your alma mater, Mililani High School.
Hey, second's not bad. At the Nationals, the top 16 high school teams and top 8 middle school teams will win $1,000 for their school's science departments. And while the prizes for this year's top finishers in both divisions has yet to be announced, last year's winners got a 9-day, all-expenses-paid science trip to Alaska. U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz said in a statement, "The National Science Bowl challenges students to excel and heightens their interest in fields vital to America's continued scientific advancement. Congratulations to these students for advancing to the national finals, and I wish them the best of luck in the competition."
Now, these guys on Maui have really been kind of kicking it. I mean, Maui High won, the Hawaii Ocean Science Bowl, and they went to the Nationals in April of 2013. And they also did pretty good in the robotics as well.
Yeah, Maui High School robotics team, the Blue Thunder, they do very well. Last year, or 2 years ago, they went to the regional finals in Oregon. But it's not just that school on Maui. Baldwin High School won the Hawaii Regional First Robotics Competition in 2013. So a lot of good things coming off that island.
Yeah, well, we'll be keeping track. And then, of course, a lot of good things coming out of the public schools here on Oahu as well. So.
Absolutely.
And Mililani High, of course.
Thank you, Bert.
And of course, here's a couple of quick items we wanted to share with you on the tech calendar. Tonight after the show, the monthly Wetware Wednesday networking mixer will be held over at the Fix Sports Lounge and nightclub over in Chinatown. Arsenal Venture Partners is January's sponsor, and they'll share what it takes to get funded. Honolulu New Tech Meetup will also feature pitches in the healthcare arena, and there will be a preview of the upcoming Startup Weekend. That's 6 p.m. tonight in Chinatown. For more information, you can visit htdc.org.
And I just got a notice that if you go, you'll be able to get a discount code for the Startup Weekend, so there's another incentive to check it out. Next Thursday, Pacific New Medium is presenting a panel discussion on my favorite topic, journalism in the digital age. The ever-changing news landscape will be discussed by panelists including Nick Grube of Civil Beat, Jared Kuroiwa, our friend and partner at KHON, and Gordon Pang from the Honolulu Star Advertiser. Again, that's next Thursday, February 6th. It'll be at 7 p.m. in Krause Hall at the University of Hawaii at Manoa campus.
That'll be a very interesting conversation. Love those guys. Anyway, now joining us in the studio is Zuma Aguiar, and she's here to tell us about the upcoming Rails Bridge event. Welcome to the show, Zuma.
Thank you. Hello.
Hello. So this Rails Bridge event, I mean, maybe give us a little background on what exactly that is.
Okay, so Rails Bridge is a nonprofit organization that encourages technologists to create spaces and places and workshops for people who want to know how to program a specific programming language called Ruby.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this new programming language. People have talked about JavaScript before and other programming languages. Right now, the new hottest programming language is Ruby. So there's this whole movement, kind of like you've heard of it before, about Girls Who Code, et cetera, Lean In, by Sheryl Sandberg, the mm-hmm. COO of Facebook, and just a lot of people who are trying to really get women and girls to learn how to code. And so Rails Bridge encourages people who want to help those that are underrepresented minorities and or just underrepresented indigenous people. So Hawaii qualifies in a lot of that area. We have lots of people that don't have access. And the biggest thing in the digital divide is access. You know, it's sure you can just assume that people should just know technology because it's 2014 and everybody should know computers. Well, we're here to actually create workshops that will actually provide that access and knowledge to underrepresented communities of Hawaii.
And I like the name of this event, Hear Me Roar. Yes. Makes sense. It kind of fits in with that theme. So tell us, I mean, what are you bringing together here?
Okay, so we have the full support of Iolani right now, and the director there has supported us a lot. We have 88 T's, Toshiba Business Schools, and the Sullivan Center for Innovation and Leadership at Iolani High School, who are helping us make this workshop possible. And the head of school of Iolani, Dr. Tim Cottrell, has said that himself, that he's wanted to give our students, both girls and boys, every opportunity to explore areas of interest, as programming has been a predominantly male-dominated field, and the number of girls going into technology and engineering sectors has declined in the past few decades. We, along with many other schools, want to give our girls the skills necessary to engage in this fast-growing area of opportunity. You get the gist.
Yeah. No.
Yeah.
This is taking place at Iolani, and I know, I understand mm-hmm. there are some Iolani girls that are going to be participating, but mm-hmm. this is open to everybody, right?
Absolutely. We are actually looking for volunteers, people who would like to help us train these women and girls how to use Ruby. So if you already know Ruby, please give us a call. You can find us on Facebook at RailsBridge Hawaii, on Twitter at RailsBridge HI. And just communicate with us, talk to us. Joe is the big organizer here, and I'm actually really, really helping him and just helping him a little bit with marketing today.
That's Joe Hekaulani.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
H-E-A-U.
Now, this is, of course, trying to support girls who are underrepresented in programming, but it's not girls only. I mean,
no, this first event is focused on women and girls. We're targeting them. But the future events for RailsBridge Hawaii are going to be all more for any age, any gender, any strata.
Now, you have been involved with High Capacity and speaking as a woman, which you are.
Yeah.
Why is it that you think, you know, women are not really well represented in this field?
Well, you know, a lot of the times, you know, first of all, we have the income gap. You know, women just don't get paid as much as men. And I know right now there's like legislature that you can get involved to try to help create equal pay for equal work. And so a lot of the times women just aren't given that opportunity. And so they stay stuck in these retail jobs or whatever and don't think that they have the time, or really they're just exhausted from working so many part-time jobs. Here in Hawaii, just to survive, you have to have about a full-time job and a part-time job to survive. So we have friends that, you know, are offering scholarships for women to teach Java. Or I know a girlfriend, she teaches programming on Tech 55. She's on television mm-hmm. and she's also teaching. She's like Mexican, actually, you know, immigrant, but she's American now, but she's teaching computer programming in Hawaii at Leeward Community College. And so there's women, but they're either really busy or they don't have enough income. That's extra time as well. Leisure, mm-hmm. you know, you really have to be supported by your parents. Like, your parents have to know that if you're going to be gone for 40 hours a week, you know, you're actually doing it for the purpose of your own development, you know, professional development. So it's I don't know. There's just all these other social reasons why women are not.
What can people expect to happen when they come? Are they going to sit down all the computers and actually code something? Or is it more learning kind of the basic concepts of how Rails work?
Well, we're actually going to have an install fest this Friday. Starts at 5 o'clock to 8 at the Sullivan Center. And it's on 563 Komoku Street. Anyway, so we're the first 3 hours from 5 p.m. to 8, we're going to have an install fest. So everybody brings their laptop, and that's the thing. You do have to have your own laptop, or you can come and look, and it'll get a little tricky, or you can just become a volunteer so that you can help people, and you'll learn in the process of helping.
So you install Ruby on your laptop, and then they sort of get you started with actually doing some maybe programs based on...
So we won't be doing any programming in the first day. It's just install fest. It's like a party, a pizza party. And then Ruby on Rails workshop, the actual workshop when we're going to start coding, is the very next day at 1:30 p.m. And then it ends till 9 o'clock at night.
Well, I hope there's pizza at the end there.
We will. We're always looking for sponsors, though. We need all the support from the community, and we're also hoping to create other programs in the community. So please give us a call if you would like to donate money for.
Give us the date again for this event.
The date is tomorrow, Friday, January 31st, 2014, starts at 5 o'clock at the Sullivan Center for Innovation and Leadership at Iolani School here in Honolulu, and Saturday, February 1st, 2014, at 1:30 to 9 p.m.
And so again, you can go to RailsBridge HI on Twitter or RailsBridge Hawaii on Facebook.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good.
And if you want to sign up right away to volunteer, you go to railsbridge.org, and we have an event. You just click there.
Okay, fantastic. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And that's what's been happening this week. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll be joined by Ted Ralston, Todd Stellanova and Jim Cristofoli to tell us what's happening in the skies over Hawaii.
How comfortable should we get with drones delivering groceries or other technologies and industries that can take advantage of unmanned aerial vehicles? We'd, of course, love your thoughts or questions as part of this conversation, so you can also give us a call at 941-3689 or toll-free from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689.
And, of course, we're monitoring Twitter, so you can tweet us your questions at Bite Marks or at Hawaii. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
He's a triathlete with a rare inherited form of vision loss who has helped raise hundreds of thousands of dollars for medical research. Danny Boren says science may be close to finding a viable treatment for his illness, and he's training for this year's Ironman to raise awareness of the need to find a cure. We'll meet him tomorrow morning at 8 on The Conversation.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Mark Nepo, author of 7,000 Ways to Listen. And next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about staying close to what is sacred.
Sunday morning at 11.
Welcome back to Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozawa.
And joining us today is Ted Ralston and Jim Cristofoli, along with Ted Stellanova.
Todd Stellanova.
Ted is an ex-aerospace industry executive and a well-respected consultant on the unmanned aerial vehicles. And, of course, Jim Cristofoli works over at the DBED in the Hawaii Office of Aerospace Development and provides a focal point with the state government for the development of an aerospace industry here in Hawaii.
He's joining us by phone, as is Todd Stellanova. He's an engineer and co-founder of DroneFlow, a Hilo company that's developing software and hardware to make civilian drone operations safer, more reliable, and more autonomous.
And what opportunities might exist in this area of UAVs? And, of course, all of you out there, we would love to hear your questions and comments. And the number to call is 941-3689 on Oahu or 1-877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. Ted, Todd, and Jim, we want to welcome you all to Bite Marks Cafe.
Aloha.
Thank you.
Aloha.
Well, Ted, you know, we'll start with you since you're here live with us in the studio. Maybe give us a little bit of, let's start a little bit with the sort of the FAA announcement about, you know, Hawaii and its partnership with Alaska and Oregon. And what does that really mean for sort of this development of drone activity?
I think it's a recognition that Hawaii, in partnership with those other states, has the variety or represents the variety of atmospheric conditions, climatic conditions, topographical conditions, and such on the hot side, tropical side, in conjunction with Alaska, which has, of course, the cold side, to provide a training and a testing ground for any kind of UAV to make sure that they operate in those variations of weather.
And Hawaii is not, it's just one of maybe six other states, I believe. That
total of six HUIs have come together, and Hawaii was picked along with, as part of the Alaska team. The role that this will produce for Hawaii is really a recognition that we have that capability and that value. There's no money that comes with it, so it's really up to us in Hawaii to develop the side aspects of testing beyond just what the FAA requires and assist the development at manufacturers with UAVs.
Now, Jim, you've actually been working on various programs and plans to be prepared to do UAV development and seeing it as an opportunity for technology development, for commerce, for quite some time. In fact, I think even before this recent announcement of this selection with the University of Alaska, there have been attempts even at through the state legislature to try and get this designation. How do you feel about this this final, you know, kind of validation of those efforts?
Well, I think it's a terrific opportunity for the state. We first heard about this back in early 2012 with the FAA Reauthorization, Modernization, and Reform Act, in which they basically were mandated by Congress to help safely integrate UAS technologies into the national airspace. And they put out a notice in the Federal Register in March of that year. We took a look at that, formed a team comprised of our department, the DOT, the State Department of Defense and various other state agencies and some private sector folks who are very interested in developing this technology for the state and applications in the Asia-Pacific region. And we're waiting for an announcement from the FAA in terms of when they'd actually start looking for these sites and the plan for designating the six regional test sites. And they finally came out with what's called a screening information request back in, actually on Valentine's Day last year, sort of a sweetheart delivery. And we took a look at that and at the same time got a call from the state of Alaska, which has been working with UAS technologies for some time. And they said, would you like to partner with us in the state of Oregon to pull together a proposal? We said, sure. So we spent the next 2.5 months submitting, crafting a 7-volume response to submit in May. And then we were just sort of in a holding pattern until last December 30, when we were notified that we were one of 6 regional test sites for unmanned aerial systems. Each of the states has different things to offer to the mix. Of course, Alaska has vast open airspace with little air traffic, wild, extreme, unpopulated, and diverse terrain, access to large military ranges with data gathering ability, and certainly a history of pioneering aviation technology in this area. The state of Hawaii has restricted airspace. It's remote from the 48 continental states, a destination launch point for very high altitude and high speed testing over water, tropical environmental conditions, long-term affiliation working with the University of Alaska, and the partnerships between our two states are quite strong. And Oregon has a number of things it brings to the mix, UAS industry test support of existing test sites, good maritime access, high desert environment. So the idea is that this tri-state proposal will form a pan-Pacific UAS test range complex in which the state of Alaska will be the lead, but the states of Hawaii and Oregon will play supporting roles. And of the 13 test ranges dedicated to this effort, 3 will be in the state of Hawaii. We're looking at the Pacific Missile Range, Wheeler Air Force Base, and the Pohakaloa Training Area on the Big Island of Hawaii. And as we build this out, engaging private sector folks to test and validate these technologies, but in restricted airspace on the ranges, under control of this program and under FAA guidelines.
You know, Jim, that's pretty good stuff, and I think it's sort of a long time in the coming. I want to get Todd involved with this conversation and find out from Todd. You know, Todd, you're out there on the Big Island. I think you have been kind of course, operating as a hobbyist, but you see the full potential of commercial applications. So how do you look at some of this activity that the FAA is looking at, and how does that affect perhaps your future involvement with operating your drones?
Right. I mean, I think the FAA approval of the test site in Hawaii is a huge opportunity for us to sort of expand the range of the conditions we can test under, the different 7 different climatic zones we can test inside of. In my mind, the Big Island is a perfect place to test all different kinds of drone technology. From a commercial standpoint, we're a little more interested in testing in places that have human activity, because that's sort of where we see a lot of the long-term applications being. But really, the FAA approval of the test site range here is sort of the first step in that process. You need to test your systems in safe places first and make sure that you're not going to injure anybody or damage property, and get all the bugs worked out in places where you're not going to do damage. Mm-hmm. And then before you move to in urban areas or places where you might damage crops and so forth. So we're really excited about the FAA announcements. We're really excited to work with the Hawaii Test Range and see what we can do with them. But we're also excited to see what we can do with things like Hawaiian tropical agriculture. Looking at things like having persistent drones in places like Hawaii Volcanoes National Park, where we can do daily surveys. Really, there's a whole range of activities we see happening here on the Big Island, and the FAA test site is kind of the first step to that.
We're talking to Ted Ralston, a renowned aviation expert and someone who definitely feels very passionately about drone technology, Todd Stellanova of DroneFlow, a Hilo company developing software for drones, and of course Jim Crisafulli from DBED, the Hawaii Office of Aerospace Development, definitely working at the ground level to make all of this happen. If you've got a question about UAVs, we'd welcome your call at 941-3689 or from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. 3689. We're also listening on Twitter. Now, Ted, the fact of the matter is people are using drones quite a bit. In fact, it was earlier this, maybe late last year, that a video went viral on The Atlantic and, you know, USA Today of a drone video of the surf break at Pipeline. And my day job is real estate. And within the real estate industry, there are a lot of people flying drones to take aerial photography. But technically, according to the FAA, this is something that can't be done right now.
That's correct. The only way you can actually use a drone today is under what's called PAO, Public Aircraft Operations, which is where a government entity, state, federal, tribal, county, city, has the right to, and with application for the right paperwork, can go ahead and use unmanned air vehicles to serve public needs. Beyond that, of course, the military has its view of how drones are used. So those are the two functionalities today.
But if I went to Amazon and I bought a $1,200 drone, I can't basically say, hey, I can get a great overhead video of your house. Just give me some money.
You can get a great overhead video of your house. You just can't sell it to anybody.
Hmm.
And you can operate it as a hobbyist, and you have certain restrictions that permit you, however, to fly it in a park or fly it in your yard, fly it down below the space inside the trees and this sort of thing that airplanes don't go, and you're fine. It just can't do it for a business.
Now the question becomes, understandably, drones in a hobbyist use can be flown under the sort of the 400-foot level, and there's a lot of places you can go underneath 400 feet, but is there really a way that the FAA can exercise sort of that jurisdiction of only hobbyists and no commercial? And what do they really sort of impart on you as a penalty if you were to do something commercial?
There was a case on Maui about a year ago, mm-hmm. where I think it was a real estate agent was using drones of some kind to photograph his offerings. And I think he took a hit from the FAA in some regard. So I think it's a, if you're in the FAA shoes, it's a real problem because there's a lot more people in the world than there are FAA people.
Mm-hmm.
So I would suspect it would take a report from somebody who's observing what's going on, someone who's threatened by it perhaps, or wonders just exactly why this person's flying a drone when you're not supposed to. So I think I'm sure it takes a lot of public input to do the policing, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Jim, I mean, it was over Christmas where Amazon made headlines saying, hey, we're trying to get to the point where we can deliver packages with drones. And the fact of the matter is they range from $300 Parrot AR drones to $12,000 EB drones mm-hmm. that you can program and everything. It's becoming more and more widespread. And this supposed ban from the FAA has been in place since 2007. Do you think that this testing program with the FAA can move fast enough to be able to have something in place before everyone's giving everyone drones for Christmas?
Well, I can't speak to the rapidity with which this will be implemented, but I know the initial vision is to have a 5 to 6 year testing period during which each of the regional test sites will work on procedures to protect manned aviation, look at policies to protect privacy, and conduct technical testing to assure control, see and avoid, loss link procedures, airworthiness, everything that can help integrate various models of UAS technologies into the national airspace. The word drone sort of carries a pejorative with it. I mean, mm-hmm. you hear a lot about drone applications in the military, the war in Pakistan, and other areas where they're used in basically combat modes. What we're talking about here are civilian and commercial applications of UAS technologies, which are really wide-ranging. We're talking about emergency search and rescue operations, wildfire detection and management, fisheries management, agricultural monitoring, surveying the health of reefs offshore, hazardous spill monitoring, algal bloom detection in the ocean, air quality monitoring, and the list goes on. Many positive applications in the private sector and public, which these technologies will enable. And the opportunities in Hawaii will be for various companies to come and test and validate applications of these technologies for these and other applications statewide.
And speaking of sort of developing technologies that can help grow this as an industry, Todd, your company is working on developing software to help, I would imagine, make operations of these unmanned aerial vehicles more safe, because I mean, the scenario that I have in my head is someday we'll get to the point where there's a large public event, let's say the lantern floating out at Magic Island, and everybody with a drone says, I'm going to go out there and fly my drone. And if suddenly you're talking about 30 of them in the skies, keeping them and everyone on the ground safe becomes a serious issue. So can you kind of quickly say what it is that Drone House is trying to provide to this growing industry?
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole range of technologies that are missing today to achieve things like, you know, like the Amazon Prime Air demo that they put out this last year. There's a bunch of technology that's just missing to make that a reality. And I think what we're trying to support today, what we're really working towards, is more of sort of the imaging drones, you know, supporting the activities of people who are doing conservation work and monitoring wildfires, like Jim was saying. Basically, we're trying to make it possible for these drones to operate frequently and to detect other drones and obstacles, and also to integrate with air traffic control so that we can have, you know, sort of a happy coexistence between, you know, manned aircraft and these drone aircraft, and, you know, drone aircraft with each other, so they understand where the other drones are and they can avoid each other. So that's kind of the safety aspect. And I think just, you know, one of the basic technologies we're working on is sort of the ability to land, recharge, and relaunch repeatedly, which, you know, if you're going to run an Amazon-type delivery service, you're going to have to run, you know, thousands of missions a day, not just individual sort of, you know, photography events.
Mm-hmm. You know, we're talking to Todd Stellanova on the Big Island. He heads up a company called DroneFlow, and we've got Ted Ralston, consultant on UAVs here in the studio, and of course Jim Cristofoli also on the phone from DBED and part of the Aerospace Department. And of course, we're talking about drones, and if you have a comment or question about drones and how to best operate them in the environment that you're in, the number to call is 941-3689 from Oahu, or 1-877-941-3689 from the neighbor islands. We want to welcome Buzz from the Big Island. Welcome to Bite Marks Cafe.
Hey, aloha, you guys. How's it going?
How's it going, Buzz?
Hey, pretty good. I've been around the drones in California when I was over there, and of course they're fantastic, especially with the cameras and all that. The thing is, I'm curious about the propulsion system. What kind of propulsion system are you guys proposing? What are we using nowadays currently?
Well, you know, that's a great question. And I think Ted's got a little drone here in the studio with us, and I'd love to hear him talk a little bit about what this is. And, of course, there's also categories of different drones. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the one that you have here in the studio.
That's a really important distinction. There are categories anywhere from, in the future, perhaps, who knows, a million-pound 747 delivering packages for mm-hmm. FedEx with nobody on board. That's one extreme, which will, of course, be jet fuel, all the way down to the hobbyist level and the starting level, entry level here at the consumer level of product, which are basically electric engines like this one here on the table. And then you could have hybrid in the middle, which we got a guy, Jim Williams, out in Kalaeloa, who has a hybrid configuration. And then there's going to be straight petrochemical propulsion.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting is the battery technology is increasing in terms of power density in the batteries, so the electric side is penetrating into the higher payloads, and the electric propulsion for the small startups is going to be here for a long time.
Mm-hmm. And I know that when we talk about payloads, that's kind of basically their carrying capacity, and that was determined. That also is determined by how much energy they can carry. A lot of drones that we see now are quadcopters. They can hover in place, but a lot of the other ones are kind of like fixed wing. They are more like gliders and are always constantly moving. Can you tell us a little bit about the advantages of either approach?
Sure. They each have their own place in the game. The helicopter configuration, the quad rotors, obviously can go straight up. They can launch straight up and return straight down. So they're very useful in a tight environment. But they don't have much footprint. That is, they're limited in speed and limited in range just because you're depending totally on propulsion for the levitation, so to speak. An airplane configuration uses the wings to generate the lifting force, and the propulsion is simply offsetting drag.
Mm.
So you get a lot more footprint for your and a lot more payload
for the energy.
For a certain power size.
Mm-hmm. Now, Buzz, did you have a second question?
Well, first of all, I thought the idea of the electric, you know, it's like the difference between a squawking crow or a flock of parrots flying versus the EO, you know, where you can't can't hear the feathers or a quail. In other words, noise is something that I'd be concerned about. I can't remember who mentioned, but about, have one area, of course, is for, looking at the volcano park, and, in other words, the out-of-the-way places. That's a great, forest, checking out animals or, land. But then there seemed to be a primary interest in not spying necessarily, but in a populated area, that you could... That seems to be an important. So obviously, I assume that these all have—they're not just carrying things from like carrier pigeons. They're carrying cameras as well, and then there's feedback in that. So I was just curious. Noise was one of the things that I wanted to object to.
It's
just getting so noisy around the Big Island anyway.
No, that's a really great point, and Ted, I mean, along with the propulsion, there's always the noise factor, and maybe part of this FAA study is going to be kind of looking at what kind of noise restrictions might be implemented.
Certainly, there are noise compliance requirements in airplanes, and logically, there'll be something coming forward in the world of UAVs. Mm-hmm. These small ones like this one, they kind of like sound like some bees going by, so mm-hmm. it depends how low they're flying, if it's irritation or not. But... the caller made some comments about imagery and such, and I wanted to address that if I can.
Well, you know what? We want to hold that one because we want to go to a quick break. We'll hold that thought. We'll be right back after this short break to continue our conversation with Ted Ralston, Todd Stellanova, and Jim Cristofoli about the potential for drone activity over Hawaii.
Certainly, noise is one concern, and obviously privacy when you're talking about cameras. We'll get to that, but we'd of course love to hear from you as well. You can give us a call at 941-3689 or from the Neighbor Islands at 877-941-3689. This is Bite Marks Cafe.
Activities are always more fun when we do them with a friend. Join us for HPR's Plus One New Member Campaign. Recruit just one person to become a new member at the special member referral rate of $25 or more. Then, you and your Plus One are invited to join us for a Pauhana recording party on Friday, February 7th. Visit the support page at hawaiipublicradio.org or call 955-8821 during business hours to participate. And thanks.
Remedies abound for the common cold, everything from zinc to chicken soup. In India, they use a simple drink made with a spice known for its healing properties.
Warm milk, a spoon of honey, a pinch of turmeric, and a pinch of black pepper. Mix it up and drink it. That's it.
I'm Sarah McConnell. Join me for With Good Reason, Thursdays at 6:30 on Hawaii Public Radio.
Welcome back. This is Bite Marks Cafe. I'm Bert Lum.
And I'm Ryan Ozal, and we're talking to Ted Ralston, Todd Stellanova, and Jim Cristofoli about an industry building to support UAVs in Hawaii.
And if you, personal or commercial drones were permitted by the FAA, how would you use it? And the number to call here is 941-3689 on Oahu or 877-941-3689 from the Neighbor Islands. And, of course, right before the break, we're kind of talking about, imagery and perhaps, Ted, you might want to share some thoughts about maybe privacy and this idea of chain of custody.
Right. The information that you're taking that's in the pictures you take belongs to somebody, and it probably doesn't belong to you. And so there has to be a control of that in some way. Just as an example, we have a team of two UH guys down in the Philippines right now using these UAVs to do Typhoon Yolanda mm-hmm. Recovery efforts. And after you get through the technology part and actually begin generating imagery, the question then becomes, who owns it? How do you deliver that imagery to the local or to the federal agencies? How do you clean it out of the computer after you've done photo mosaicing it and such so that the information remains in the Philippines, even though you had it temporarily under your control while you're taking it?
Mm-hmm.
So thinking first how the imagery is going to get used and what your path is and how you're going to identify the latency, how long is this imagery good for, how do you notify somebody that's available, how do you put a quality check on it? Because people are going to depend on that imagery. So we really have to think this thing through from the other direction as far as imagery is concerned. Mm-hmm. And the UAV is simply a platform that holds the imager.
Now, Todd, you're on the Big Island. I know that the Google Trike and the Google Backpack has been out there, and I think Google has been sort of pushing the envelope on this sort of privacy and what you can collect by walking on trails and driving the car on various paths. But Todd, do you have any thoughts on this sort of idea of the chain of custody for imaging resources that come from the drones?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think the trend I'm seeing now, thinking of commercial applications, there's this trend now for farmers and others to collect their own imagery data of their own land and their own property. So I think you're going to see more and more individual property owners, running their own UAVs or running them in co-ops with others. Mm-hmm. And collecting imagery basically of their own property. Now, there may be some sort of overlap with other people's property as they pick up that information. So that's something else to think about. And, of course, there is always the ongoing issue of, big companies like Google and even public agencies photographing people in their own on their own property. So there's a complex issue, and Ted's right. We really haven't figured out all the sort of chain of custody issues there. I think it's going to get more interesting as more and more private individuals own their own drones and operate them in co-ops. I think we're going to see more and more people collecting, like farmers, for example, collecting images of their cornfields and understanding where crops are being damaged by pests and disease. This is going to become more and more commonplace, and I think there's going to have to be sort of neighborly rules about how you share data with each other and mend fences, that kind of thing.
Right.
It's going to get more complex over time because there's not going to be just the government necessarily collecting information. There's going to be people taking photographs all over the place.
Now, Jim,
Bert, if I could just chime in for a second.
Yeah.
Many of these concerns are national, not just local, and there are several groups out there that have made a concerted effort to define what the issues are and how to address them. In particular, the Aerospace States Association, the Council of State Governments, and the National Conference of State Legislatures. They convened two sets of meetings last fall and developed sort of a manifesto which both outlines the issues and ways to address them. And several bills in the current session and our state legislature are looking at these issues and trying to figure out how best to adapt the recommendations from these bodies to our state. But as we build out our unmanned aerial system test sites here, we certainly will be looking very closely at procedures to protect privacy and safety, integrating these systems into the national airspace.
Good stuff. We're talking to Jim Cristofoli from DBED, Todd Celanova from the Big Island with Drone Flow, and, of course, Ted Ralston here, consultant on UAVs. And if you got a question or comment about the drones and how to best use them, you can give us a call here. Number is 941-3689, or from the neighbor islands at 877-941-3689. We want to welcome George from Honolulu. Welcome to Bite Marks Cafe.
Hey, aloha, gents. Appreciate taking my call.
Sure thing.
Yeah, this is a great program, and it's the future's here, and I embrace it. So I spent a bit of coin investing in a UAV platform, primarily for film, television, marketing, publicity, perhaps architectural and construction capabilities to help those industries.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not easy to pilot, to carry a high-definition video camera or HDSLR camera worth a lot of money. And so, I want to make sure I'm good at it and making sure that I can operate it safe and low-altitude safe, flying. Question is, before the FAA sets down a bunch of rules next year, I believe, you mentioned about commercial work. If I was flying it for, say, a golf course or a resort entity or even helping a farmer, research forest management or crop management, would that be considered a safe venture? And also what I did do is I have $2 million worth of insurance as well. So I'm trying to make it safe. I just don't want to be any yahoo out there that can say, yeah, I can do it, and crash into a building or worse yet, hurt someone.
That is a great question, George. And I want to give it over to Ted because he's ready to answer this one.
Yeah, these things are complex, and there's always a gray area. If a farmer has the right to fly over his own property and use the imagery for his own purposes, Anything else has to be under what's called, again, as I said before, public aircraft ops, which is for the benefit of the public and by a public agency. There is no other place in the middle there where commercial operations of drones can occur. Now, you could have an airspace area that's controlled like a soundstage, where that's no problem, and you can operate them as a hobbyist. But that's the hobby rules, the FAA rules for the AMA, do not allow commercial operations other than demonstrations of a product to somebody who might want to buy it. So it's a ticklish situation.
So
right now.
So the FAA has clearly set the groundwork. I mean, in terms of the policy of no commercial.
That's right, and even in the public aircraft ops rules, under which we operate police helicopters and such. That are auto certification. The same is true there. That there's no commercial possibility there.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to be very careful about that.
And I will say, Bert and I were interacting with Travis here in Honolulu as well, and he's following very closely a current court case because someone got in trouble for being hired to do video for a resort, and he basically said the FAA says this is a rule, but they didn't go through the regular rulemaking process, so I say it's invalid. And there's a lot of people waiting to see how that goes. But to be perfectly honest, yes, if you sell your services as a drone operator, you are going against what the FAA says is the current setup.
And also, I think what the policy that the FAA implements is one of a $10,000 penalty. So if you were to let's say in this case, this guy's name is his code name is Trappy, and he's considered like an aerial anarchist. But his trial is being very closely watched because it's really testing the FAA to determine whether or not he is in violation of anything. And it'll be interesting to see what happens. And there's a lot of people watching this one. But you know, in terms of
thank you very much, by the way, George, for your question. And I definitely laud you for trying to be as responsible in operation as possible, because the whole concern is irresponsible operation.
Right. No, and George, I think it is a good thing to sort of be cautious of how to proceed with this, because it is a very sensitive area, I think, at this stage. But I think, you know, right now there's a policy, and I think the policy is being tested. And Ted, I don't know, maybe you can share some thoughts on how you would advise people to proceed, you know, if they were to go down this path.
Yeah, on that issue of the policy that's being tested, the quote-unquote rules that we speak of that deny commercial operations is really under what's called an advisory circular coming out of the FAA, which is not the same thing as a rule.
It's not a law. Right.
It's one means of complying, but it's not the only means of complying. And so that's the gray area in terms of how this is being looked at.
Mm-hmm.
So, like we're saying, just keep a low profile. And
maybe not set up a website with, buy my services and
that's
$500
an
hour or whatever.
Yeah,
probably not good. Let me go to Todd. So, Todd, I love what you're doing. And, of course, you are among many people posting videos of your drone flights and testing your software and videos. But I got to say, when Bert and I were researching this story, looking for an increasingly large number of YouTube videos taken from drones, already you kind of see an interest maybe even toward more prurient sides, where let's fly over Miami Beach and get shots of all the girls in bikinis and go over the private yachts. And I think you can see a lot of reasons why some people are kind of concerned about this, not just government surveillance, but your nosy neighbor. So, I mean, how do you address those concerns when someone sees you out in your field on the Big Island flying your drone?
Sure. I mean, I think there's definitely a reasonable concern that people have when they see these things flying around. And I think a lot of the current danger or the perceived danger is that there's a lot of yahoos flying around this equipment they don't really understand or really know how to pilot. There's a lot of people who are brand new to the hobby because it's really only exploded in the last couple of years. So I think there's definitely a reasonable concern that there's unskilled pilots essentially piloting these larger and larger vehicles around, carrying these large, camera payloads. I think, our goal long-term, of course, is safety, and we want to ensure that, to the extent possible, we automate out the danger. So if there's ways that we can, use the onboard computers and the ground computers and, two-way communications to sort of make those flights automatically safer rather than having manual control over the flights, we're going to strive for, the different technological means to make those flights safer. So they're basically foolproof. I think long-term we're seeing for commercial applications, these are going to be fully autonomous flights where the flight paths are determined ahead of time. We know exactly what altitude they're flying, what their flight path is going to be, all their payload characteristics. So we want to really minimize the danger and, you know, the possibility that you're going to pick up imagery, for example, that you don't want, that might expose you to lawsuits, that kind of thing. Really, we're just trying to get these drones out there doing jobs that are helpful to people and not expose them or, you know, people to danger.
Well, that's good stuff. You know, Jim, you mentioned the FAA selection of the consortium Hawaii, Alaska, and Oregon. And I think it might have been Ted that mentioned that there wasn't any real money involved with that. I'm kind of curious, Jim, from your perspective, you know, if we're sort of involved with the monitoring, the safety, you know, looking at categorizing different sort of drones, how will that effort be funded? I mean, is that something that DBED is looking to help fund? Is the state is going to, you know, get involved with, you know, maybe allocating some money toward those kinds of studies? How do you see that actually getting fulfilled? Oh, Jim? Maybe I should say that. Maybe Ted, maybe you can help me out with the understanding. How is it that this effort or this project that the FAA has anointed to Hawaii, is that going to get funded?
Well, that again goes to the not to the FAA to fund it. It's going to be up to the state or up to private industry to create these testing methods and testing centers and such. Mm-hmm. And really, it's very similar to the automotive testing. You go in and get your car serviced once a year, but the guy doesn't make money on that. He makes money on changing your transmission, changing your engine. So the real money is going to be made in assisting manufacturers continuously testing, continuously improving and upgrading their systems. Finally, they get them to the point of the certification test, and now the part that the FAA allows us to do is a certification test.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm guessing that the value is going to be, I don't know, 80% in the private side of the house and only 20% actually doing certification testing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yes, sorry, Bert, I had my phone here on mute. There's some noise in the background. But, yeah, there are a couple of bills currently in session that will provide some preliminary funding to hire a COO and executive assistant to help build the program out. But I think Ted's right on the mark there. Eventually we're going to attract various companies and organizations that will want to test and validate in Hawaii. And because of the unique resources we have here, we will be an attractive site. Not to mention that after hours, you can go down to the beach and surf, and that really has a big impact on several companies. It has in the past, anyway, attracted them to Hawaii. But
well,
I just wanted to mention there's a group in Washington that's looking at both the regulatory side and the commercial development side. It's called the Joint Planning and Development Office. It's comprised of six federal agencies, including NASA, Department of Commerce, the Federal Aviation Administration, Department of Transportation, and others. And we're working very closely with them to come up with a paradigm that will enable both effective demonstration and testing of the technologies, as well as subsequent commercial development, especially with the Department of Commerce, to try and figure out ways to get companies involved through partnerships with the state and create new jobs, revenue streams, and business development opportunities for Hawaii.
We've barely scratched the surface of this topic, but we definitely appreciate you joining us on the air today.
Well, you know, and of course, you know, we'll probably have all these guys come back on and share, you know, some of the other activities that are going on in drone activity. Ted Ralston is a consultant on issues related to UAVs. And of course, Todd Stellanova is an engineer and co-founder of Drone Flow, a Hilo company. And of course, Jim Cristofoli directs the Office of Aerospace over at DBED. And we want to thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Bite Marks Cafe. Join us next week when we'll talk about the feasibility of an undersea power cable.
And of course, if you missed any part of this edition, you can find the podcast of tonight's show on bitemarkscafe.org. And of course, I'll provide you with all the show links there as well. And of course, if you have any comments or suggestions, you can email us at feedback@bitemarkscafe.org. And of course, you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Bite Marks.
And you can follow me at Hawaii. Our engineer is David Chong, and our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And we leave you with our song pick of the week. Here's a Grammy Award winner Daft Punk and a song called Motherboard. See you next week on another edition of Bite Marks Cafe.